Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau. This week marks the start of Women's History Month, and we'll be honoring the annual event with an interview with Estelle Friedman, the author of No Turning Back, The History of Feminism and the Future of Women. And following that, as the body count continues to climb in Iraq, Dennis Giangreco will join us to tell us about complications that have arisen in the past from publicly reported casualty figures during wartime. But first, let's take a look at a few items of historical interest in the news during this Women's History Month. The discovery of the remains of two Amazon warriors serving with the Roman army in Britain has astonished archaeologists. Women soldiers were previously unknown in the Roman army in Britain, so the find in the Cumbria region will force a reappraisal of their role in 3rd century society. The women are thought to have come from the Danube region of Eastern Europe, which was where the ancient Greeks said the fearsome Amazon warriors could be found. The women, believed to have died sometime between AD 220 and 300, were burnt on pyres upon which were placed their horses and military equipment. The remains were uncovered in the 1960s, but full-scale analysis and identification have been possible only since 2000 with new technological advances. The soldiers are believed to have been part of the Numeri, a Roman irregular unit which would have been attached to a legion serving in Britain. Though the Numeri are generally referred to as irregular units, Hilary Cook, the director of the Barbican Research Associates, explained, they're not thought of as having women among their ranks. However, the unit came from the area where the ancient Greeks placed the origins of woman warriors called Amazons. Could the Numeri be even more irregular than anyone ever dreamt? The bodies were among the remains of more than 180 people buried in a cemetery that was part of a fort and civilian settlement dating to the 3rd century. And a brief entry in the diary of the wife of a British spy has led to the discovery of the true story behind one of the greatest mysteries of the Second World War, the bizarre 1941 flight to Britain of Hitler's deputy Rudolf Hess. No single incident in Britain's wartime history has given birth to so many conspiracy theories, all of them centered on an alleged plot by the intelligence service to lure Hess to Britain. The response from academics has been disparaging of these theories for the most part, but the diary has revealed that Britain's MI6 was heavily involved in planning a sting operation aimed at luring Hess or another prominent German into bogus peace talks with Britain. The diary belonged to the wife of Frank Foley, the former MI6 head of station in Berlin. It was Foley, we now know, who was in charge of the operation that lured Hess to Britain under the pretense of entering into peace talks and an alliance in making war on the Soviet Union. Yet to come, Estelle Friedman on the history of feminism and Dennis Giangreco on body counts in war. You're listening to Talking History.
Numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend. 'Cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. Oh, yes.
In the past two centuries, a revolution has transformed women's lives. Unlike national revolutions, this social upheaval crosses continents, decades, and ideologies. In place of armed struggle, it gradually sows seeds of change, infiltrating our consciousness with the simple premise that women are as capable and as valuable as men. So writes our guest this week, Estelle Friedman, in the introduction to her latest book, No Turning Back, The History of Feminism and the Future of Woman, published by Ballantine Books. Friedman is Edgar E. Robinson Professor in U.S. History at Stanford University, where she founded the program in Feminist Studies. Welcome, Estelle.
Glad to be with you.
In No Turning Back, you explain why and how the feminist revolution occurred, and that's going to be the focus of our conversation. But let's start at a more basic level, as you do in your book, by defining and maybe giving a very brief history of the term feminism.
I'd be glad to start with that. Feminism has many definitions. Let me begin by being historical, and then I'll be ahistorical, if you don't mind. Historically, the term originated in France as féminisme in the late 19th century, really the mid to late 19th century, and it was referring to a social movement, an ism, that had to do with women or promoting women, just like socialism was another, communism was another. So it was thought of in terms of fairly radical social movements. When the term appears in the United States in around 1910 and becomes popularized in the teens and the 20s, it had a very specific political meaning, and that was equal rights for women. Women are the same as men, as opposed to the 19th century broader women's movement, which often argued for rights for women in the name of their difference from men, particularly their capacity for motherhood. Feminism changes its meaning again over the decades, and I would say by the 60s, the 70s, by the so-called revival or second wave of American feminism, when the term women's liberation is used, feminism is more of an umbrella term for anyone who questions gender hierarchy, who questions the subordination of women, and it becomes modified. So you would get liberal feminism, radical feminism, male feminism, ecofeminism, women of color feminism. In other words, it's a very malleable term. Now, that's my historical response, but I actually do give a definition in the book if you'd like me to give you my definition.
Sure, go ahead.
It's that feminism is a belief that women and men are inherently of equal worth. Because most societies privilege men as a group, social movements are necessary to achieve equality between women and men, with the understanding that gender always intersects with other social hierarchies.
Okay, good.
Now, that's a broad definition, but as we talk, I hope that it will get unpacked.
Yeah, it will. You point to two historical transitions that have propelled feminist politics, the rise of capitalism and new political theories of individual rights and representative government. Let's start by talking about capitalism first.
Well, I think that you can find a correlation between wage labor systems. As an older family, self-sufficient economy gives way with commerce and industrialization to people leaving the family, earning wages, having more autonomy to some extent, that you can find a correlation between that phenomenon economically and the second point, which is political rights, individual rights, representative government. We shift from a hierarchical society, whether it's feudal economic relations or allegiance to one's superiors, to a world, a so-called modern world, in which individual actors are supposedly the agents of change. And feminism, of course, is the movement to extend that principle of individual rights, as well as the rights of workers, to women as well as men.
Okay, so you connected the two.
Yes.
When we look at further in your book, you write, in the course of one remarkable generation, and that's clearly true, and I didn't quite realize that in the 19th century, feminism burst onto the Western political stage with demands for education, property rights, suffrage, and more. So where did all that begin, and how did it begin in the United States?
You can find it in the United States, in Germany, in France, in England, certainly by the 1840s everywhere, although you can see precursors, Mary Wollstonecraft in the 18th century, for example. But as you have those two preconditions we just talked about, wage labor systems, political rights of man influencing revolutions, you get that first generation of women raised with a little bit of education and, in a sense, taking to the logical extreme these ideals. And in the United States in particular, there's a fairly well-known story of the connection between women who are involved in reform movements, particularly anti-slavery and abolition, women who want to change the world and create more social justice, turning those theories on themselves and realizing, as the Grimke sisters did in the 1830s, as they worked for the rights of slaves, that talking about the rights of slaves and being questioned about women's right to speak publicly against slavery made them think about the rights of women, the rights to speak out politically. As women got some education and had aspirations for certain kinds of, say, professional work, medical school, clergy, law, and could not get that training, they began to agitate for more rights for education. And then I think particularly in terms of property rights, the movement for married women's property rights, that husbands would not own the property of their wives, goes along with this shift towards individualism. So in the United States, particularly in the 1840s, all of these come together in Seneca Falls, New York, when Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott are both living near there, call this meeting, and hundreds of women and men come to talk about the rights of women. And it takes off continuously throughout history. There, yes, are waves, there's ups and downs, but from the 1830s, 1840s onward, there's always a set of organizations that are trying to expand women's rights in the United States.
You referenced it earlier, but perhaps you'd want to say a little bit more about the idea of race and the politics of identity in this feminist movement.
Well, as I said, in the 19th century, feminism was partially born within a movement for racial justice, within the abolitionist movement. A lot of the women who were active in the early women's rights movement came out of anti-slavery, and a lot of the male allies who were at Seneca Falls or who supported the women's cause were also abolitionists or anti-slavery activists. So you had an overlap in the early 19th century, which tragically split in the late 19th century as, in a sense, the white reformers and the issue of black rights were not always in alliance. For some people they were, but for others there was a sense of competition when the so-called Civil War amendments to the Constitution granted, among other things, suffrage to black men, but not to black or white women. And there's a period in the late 19th, early 20th century when the two movements are, I would say, weak and not in alliance. Okay. You begin to get some alliance building in the 20s and 30s through sort of early civil rights in the South, and then really with the big push in the 50s, 60s for civil rights, you can see the links again where another generation of women involved in the Southern civil rights movement begin to question women's rights and go on to found these women's liberation groups. So you can see it goes back and forth in our history between alliance and separation. And my argument in the book is that both race and gender politics are stronger when they're in alliance with each other and supporting each other rather than in some kind of competition. Now, there's more to the politics of identity, of course, in that there's more than one racial group or so-called racial group in the United States. There's a long history of black-white relations, but it gets more complicated in terms of women involved in feminism recognizing their multiple identities. Mexican-American women, Native American women, lesbians, disabled women. So not just race, but other kinds of political identities. And since the 1960s, the American women's movement has really had to come to terms with these overlapping identities. That's why I said in that definition that I gave you earlier that feminism always has to take into account its intersection with other social hierarchies. As some writers have explained more eloquently than I can right now, that if you just talk about women and assume you're talking about white middle-class women, as Betty Friedan was in The Feminine Mystique, you're not really talking about women, you're talking about only certain women. But if you really are talking about all women, you're going to have to address racial justice, issues of sexuality, disability rights, issues of poverty, and that feminism has had to take account and become more inclusive not only of who can be a feminist, but what's the agenda, that it's not simply a self-aggrandizement of privileged women getting more privilege, but asking what all women need.
Good point. Okay. You devote another section of your book to sexualities, identities, and self-determination. Let's just focus on one of those sections, given the time we have, and let's take the section you titled Resisting and Expanding Western Sexualities.
Well, what I mean by that is really it illustrates a larger point that just as within the United States there's a diversity of identities and interests, internationally as well, we can't make assumptions that the politics of sexuality in the contemporary United States is the appropriate politics of sexuality in other parts of the world. And thus, we not only see Western sexualities exported and expanded, but also resisted. Let me give you an example, and that would be of an Egyptian woman writer who looks at American critiques or Western critiques of women who are veiled and says back to the West, when I look at the billboards of women in bikinis, when I hear about women and their cosmetic surgery, when I hear about the exploitation of women sexually in the West, I'm not sure I want your liberation. And so it's a two-way critique that it's not just we have somehow liberated sexuality and want to export that to the rest of the world, but that we need to be critical of our own sexual politics and ask, what are the needs elsewhere that may be different? Let me give you another quick example, and that is the whole worldwide movement against female genital cutting. When Western women go into Africa and say, this is a terrible practice because it denies women sexual pleasure, that may not resonate as the key issue in cultures where it's really about life and death. This may not be a good practice for us because it's unhealthy and girls may die. That might also be a more appropriate argument than let's expand sexual pleasure. And so we have to understand the differences in the sexual and political cultures in which we're having these dialogues around the world.
And I should take advantage of that opportunity because you've mentioned two examples that your book delves in great detail in feminism in other parts of the world and not just in the United States. But for the sake of time and the nature of this program, we have focused on the United States. So our listeners should know that if they care to go out and get the book, they'll find much more information there than just about feminism and the history of the United States. Let's try to wrap this up a bit here by talking about the future. Now, I know that historians in general like to explain the past, but they back up when you ask them to look ahead as to where we might be going. But let me give you a chance, see if you'll take the challenge here. What challenges lie ahead for women in the feminist revolution?
Well, I'm going to answer it in two ways, and I don't want to contradict myself. I just want to be complex and honest that, on the one hand, I titled my book, No Turning Back, to signal the momentum of history. That is, there has been several hundred years of change. The political and economic changes that we talk about that undergird feminism are continuing. Globalization of the economy, democratization movements around the world. And I predict that feminism will continue to expand, redefine itself, reshape. Local feminisms around the world will continue to have an impact on world politics. And I believe that's the dominant theme. But there are a number of historical challenges I feel I should recognize. One is that we are now living in a moment of backlash against feminism in a number of cultures, not everywhere in the world, but in the United States to some extent, in Japan, in some parts of Europe. And there are a couple of challenges to historical momentum theories. That is, there's always contingency, there's always agency. And I think one of the challenges is fundamentalism, that is religious fundamentalism of any stripe, whether it's Christian, Protestant, Jewish, Catholic, Muslim. Anytime you begin to get people talking about God ordains men's power over women, God ordains that women were made to bear children, or another kind of fundamentalism I'll come to later, which is sort of a biological fundamentalism. But whenever you get people invoking religion to say that there are fixed places for men and women, you have to worry about whether that is going to undercut the political momentum we've been talking about. Another, as I alluded to a moment ago, what I call the biological fundamentalism, the idea that women are naturally the nurturers and should stay at home, and men are naturally sexually aggressive and there's always going to be rape, for example. I think that's a challenge. I think we're having a resurgence of biological reductionism these days. A lot of theories about how everything is hardwired. And I think feminists have to always be alert and vigilant about the implications of those theories. I want to be very clear. I'm not saying all religion or all biology is against feminism. That's not the case. There are many correlations of feminists within religious groups, feminists within science, who are trying to further the momentum we're talking about. I'm really only talking about those who take a fairly closed fundamentalist view that doesn't have room for historical change.
Okay, agreed.
And then I think, you know, there are some political right-wing movements that like to draw on gender nostalgia. If only women stayed home and had children, then everybody would have a job and there wouldn't be any crime, and let's get women back in the home. We have to watch out for all of those, lest the momentum I've been describing be stopped.
Okay. Well, we ordinarily have on this program our site of the week, in which we have our listeners learn about a site where they can learn more about the information discussed in the interview. But I think we're going to let you do it this week because you have a site of your own. So tell us about the site, what's in it, and where is it?
The easy way to remember this site is No Turning Back, the title of the book. And you can find it at noturningback.stanford.edu. It's also ntb.stanford.etu. I should warn your listeners, there's no W's in this URL. It's just http://noturningback.stanford.edu. That's where you can find it.
Okay, I'll have you repeat that in a minute, but what are they going to find when they get there?
Well, you have two places you can enter. The book site, which will show you reviews or anything you want to know about the book. And then there's a site called the Feminist Resource Site. And when you go into that, it's organized by chapters of the book. And for each chapter, there are links to historic documents that are online that might be mentioned in the chapter, to organizations in the United States and around the world that might be mentioned in the chapter. There's suggestions for films, documentary films. There are some links to interactive web pages where you can get involved or donate or get more information. There's data about some of the things in the book. And, in fact, I have a correction to a data error. You know, anything that's updated in the book will be there. And there's a place for people to send in their suggestions for links on the topics of the chapters of the book. And I've been adding organizations and documents as people send them in.
Well, it's a great resource on top of a good book, and I just think the combination is dynamite. But let's have it one more time. Where do we find it?
The URL is http://noturningback.stanford.edu or http://ntb.stanford.edu. And Stanford, of course, is STANFORD.
Great. Thank you, Estelle.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Estelle Friedman, Edgar E. Robinson, professor in U.S. history at Stanford University and the author of No Turning Back, The History of Feminism and the Future of Woman, published by Ballantine Books. This is Talking History.
With a smile on your face and show the world all the love in your heart. Then people gonna treat you better. You're gonna find, yes you will, that you're beautiful as you feel. Waiting at the station with a workday window blowing.
And finally, as promised, for our commentary of the week, Dennis Giangreco offers us some historical perspective on the tricky business of reporting wartime casualties by looking back at how President Franklin Roosevelt handled it during World War II. Jean Greco is an editor of Military Review and the author of Spinning the Casualties, Media Strategies During the Roosevelt Administration, which appeared in the December 2004 issue of Passport, the Journal of the Society for Historians of American Foreign Policy.
As the tally of American dead in Iraq moved in fits and starts towards the 1,000 mark, both opponents and proponents of the war geared up for the potential effects that the millennium number would have on public opinion. Intriguingly, it was exactly 60 years ago that the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt dealt with its own threshold casualty number of 1.5 million during World War II. During the mid-war years, the Roosevelt administration was receiving a considerable amount of flack in the press because America was not shouldering as much of the burden as the British and Soviets. To help counter this, the criteria for what the War Department publicly released as U.S. losses was expanded in the spring of 1944 to include a number of administrative categories that had little to do with combat, but implied that America was pulling a greater share of the load. Unfortunately, the increased tempo of combat operations following D-Day in France soon caused real casualties to soar. The Army called this the casualty surge. By August 1944, just 3 months after D-Day, it was clear that publicly released and inflated figures for the Army's total losses were on track to pass the 1.5 million mark late in 1944. Beginning in November, the Army publicly experimented with various formulas that narrowed the criteria for the casualty data it made public. A commonality of these new formulas was that they all had the effect of both restarting casualty counts from new lower baselines and masking the rate of growth. Even this, however, did little to obscure the fact that America was by now suffering an average of 65,000 casualties each and every month during the casualty surge, with November, December, and January figures standing at 72,000, 88,000, and 79,000, respectively, in post-war tabulations. Early in 1945, as the administration geared up for the planned invasion of Japan, it finally stopped releasing cumulative casualty figures altogether. At the same time, Roosevelt's Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, announced that Selective Service inductions would be nearly doubled to a figure that seems truly remarkable today and even during the Vietnam era, fully 100,000 men per month.
You've been listening to Dennis Jean Greco, the author of Spinning the Casualties, Media Strategies During the Roosevelt Administration, which appeared in the December 2004 issue of Passport, the Journal of the Society for Historians of American Foreign Policy. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show and recognition of Women's History Month. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer. Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And as always, we invite you to send us your comments and suggestions. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.